Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer and WNYC, thanks for tuning in. With me now, Dan Clydman from Newsweek, one of the reporters named as receiving White House leaks on the drone and cyber attacks. Those would have been for his new book, Kill or Capture, The War on Terror and the Soul of the Obama Presidency. Dan, thanks for coming in. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having me, Brian. I appreciate it.
And we will get to the alleged leaks and whether you think national security is being endangered to make the president look tough in the campaign. But let's talk about the bigger picture first, the president at war. Your story is of a candidate of high idealism, quickly shifting once he took office. Did he have an aha moment in the Situation Room?
You know, look, there's always a disjuncture between the idealism of a campaign and the reality of governing. And I think every president experiences it. They experience it maybe more acutely when it comes to national security. Once you assume that office, you realize the awesome and sobering responsibilities of protecting the United States, protecting its citizens. And you also see, in a way that most Americans don't see, the nature of the threats that are out there. And so the one thing I would say is President Obama has gotten an enormous amount of attention for how aggressively he's fought this war on terrorism in places like Pakistan and Yemen and Somalia, particularly with the use of drone strikes. If you go back to the campaign, when he talked about these issues, he talked mostly about rolling back the controversial Bush-Cheney policies, closing Guantanamo, ending torture, warrantless wiretapping, various other things. The one thing you didn't hear him talk about was criticize – he did not criticize the drone program. And I think he understood, even back during the campaign at a certain level, that this particular program – which was being described to him as being quite targeted and surgical, was actually in line with his basic MO.
And yet one moment early on where the president's values shine through and question the drone program as it's being waged is when he learns about the very first drone strike fired on his watch as commander-in-chief. Can you tell us that story?
Yes, and this is a bit of an aha moment because he has been told about the precision of these strikes. And this is January 23rd. It's literally hours after he has signed the executive orders rolling back some of those Bush-Cheney policies, calling for the closing down of Guantanamo, for example. John Brennan, his chief counterterrorism advisor, comes to him in the Oval Office and says, "Mr. President, the first drone strikes of your presidency have been fired. Unfortunately, we got the wrong guy. They killed a tribal elder in Pakistan, a pro-peace person, and much of his family." And the president, as you can imagine, is quite disturbed by this. Remember, this is the president who was going to change the message to the Muslim world, and yet here he is 3 days into his presidency killing innocent Muslims.
But there was a policy decision attached to that, if I understand your book correctly, which is that they have to decide between what they call signature strikes, which can be almost like profiling on a group based on how that group looks from the air, and targeted killings of really identified individuals. Can you explain the difference in what the president has done and where that instance came into play?
Yes, and this is a really important kind of inflection point in his presidency. The president calls in the head of the CIA and his deputy. It was Mike Hayden, who was the holdover Bush administration CIA chief. And these two CIA officials are explaining to him what happened. And in the context of that conversation, they start explaining to him for the first time what a signature strike is. Now, a signature strike is where you don't know the identity of the individuals that you're targeting. You know that they are in some ways associated with terrorism. They have certain characteristics associated with terrorism. That's distinguished from a personality strike when they have positive ID, or as positive it can be. President is kind of trying to wrap his mind around this, and he says, "Well, that's just not good enough for me." But the conversation continues, and he's still listening, and they make a persuasive case to him that in Pakistan, they should be allowed to continue these kinds of strikes. It has to do with the quality of the intelligence they have there and other considerations. But importantly, So the president actually continues to approve these strikes in Pakistan, but then the military has its own targeted killing program. They also use drones as well as other munitions. He holds the line with respect to the military, and he pushes back against them in terms of signature strikes in places like Yemen and Somalia for most of the first 3 years of his presidency.
Dan Kleinman from Newsweek. His new book, being much talked about now, is Kill or Capture, The War on Terror and the Soul of the Obama Presidency. And folks, you can call in for Dan Kleinman on the president's war policies themselves and how different they are or are not from President Bush's and some of the particular conflicts that we'll get into among members of the president's own cabinet on how to wage the war on terror post-Bush. Or we can get into the leak story that's in the news right now and then the investigation into how and why some information that seems to have made its way into Daniel's book has done so. 212-433-WNYC. 212-433-9692 or post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. On the civilians, the liberals versus the pragmatists, Attorney General Eric Holder is a big loser in your story over and over again on Guantanamo, on civilian trials like KSM in Manhattan, ending indefinite detention, all those things. What has Attorney General Eric Holder's role been?
Well, Attorney General Eric Holder, when he came in, believed that he would be fulfilling many of the promises that President Obama made during the campaign. The Attorney General occupies a unique role in government because they're supposed to be independent, and they are allowed to operate with a kind of independence that other cabinet members don't. And he took that seriously. When the administration began, fairly quickly, people in the White House began to see how much opposition there was in Congress to some of these policies. Moreover, the president inherited an economy that was still in free fall, and the administration, President Obama, made a choice to pursue health care as his chief priority. And so there was a kind of a collision course that was set in place almost from the very first days of the administration. And over and over again, Eric Holder, who was pushing for these policies, ran up against intense opposition within his own administration. And I was surprised at how heated and sometimes just personally nasty it became.
There's one scene in which you say Holder and political advisor David Axelrod nearly came to blows.
That's right. This was in May of 2009. And the backdrop is this clash of principle and politics, to simplify it, that we were just talking about. But the specific context was that the White House believed that Holder had made some early political stumbles. He gave a speech about race in which he used the infelicitous phrase, nation of cowards. He made some comments about gun control that caused political problems inside the White House. And David Axelrod, really at the behest of Rahm Emanuel, the chief of staff, wanted to try to place someone on Holder's staff that was was more deft politically and would be able to help coordinate communications and PR with the White House. Well, this was not something that sat well with the Attorney General, who felt that they were trying to put a minder essentially on his staff. And there was a confrontation in the West Wing of the White House. Axelrod believed that Holder and his aides were spreading the word that he was trying to interfere with the operations of the Justice Department, that he was behaving like Karl Rove, who was accused of doing that during the Bush administration. And it was a very heated confrontation. Axelrod said, "I'm not Karl Rove." Holder took offense at the accusation, they were really chest to chest. Valerie Jarrett, the president's close advisor and friend, whose sort of sense of decorum was disturbed by this, sort of got in between them and told them to take it out of the hallway.
And what actually happened? Do you think that Axelrod was just trying to have somebody in there to monitor Holder's language so he didn't say things like, nation of cowards that would turn people off, or was he trying to influence military policy for political reasons?
I found no evidence that Axelrod or really anyone in the White House was trying to improperly influence policy at the Justice Department. I think that this is a pressure cooker environment. They were preoccupied with their domestic agenda. They were worried about distraction. Modern White Houses are obsessed with message discipline. And when a cabinet secretary goes off message, they do whatever they can to try to rein them in, and that's what was going on here. But the backdrop, of course, is the concern about these counterterrorism policies, which were sort of very controversial.
Daniel Kleinman from Newsweek. We're talking about his book, Kill or Capture, The War on Terror and the Role of the Obama Presidency. In a little while, we'll get into the leaks that may have contributed to this book and the investigations into those leaks. 212-433-WNYC, if you want to join us. When you frame these camps as liberals versus pragmatists, are the pragmatists those, like Rahm Emanuel, who think we need to be this tough to keep the nation safe, or are they political pragmatists seeking to keep the president viable?
You know, it's some combination. And it's, you know, you have to say that the pragmatists, some of the pragmatists also have liberal views and a liberal core. Some of the liberals also have pragmatic streaks. Eric Holder could be pragmatic on some of these issues. He's a former prosecutor and a judge and was a pretty tough sentencer. But I think what you would hear over and over again from people in the White House on these issues was, look, we have to deal in the world that we're in. We only have a certain amount of political capital. We have to choose and prioritize. They called it triage, and they had to make certain choices because otherwise they would not get important things done that they thought they needed to get done. At the same time, the more liberal-minded people in places like the Justice Department, I think, also understood that there were certain lines that needed to be drawn for pragmatic purposes. The issue is that Attorney General Holder, I think, believed that if you constantly said, look, we can't fight these battles because of the effect that it'll have on our domestic agenda, it's a kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. You begin to look weak if you don't stand up and fight for them. And I think that's the view of a lot of people.
How about the particular case, so relevant to New York, of the Khalid Sheikh Mohammed trial, which Holder wanted to hold in civilian court here in Manhattan? Did you unearth anything new as to why that decision really was changed and how much that was a matter of justice and how much that was a matter of politics?
Well, I think that from the very beginning, Rahm Emanuel, the chief of staff in the White House, was very uncomfortable with that particular decision. I don't think he believed that that was a core concern of the American people, that they were going to ultimately vote on whether Khalid Sheikh Mohammed or any of the other 9/11 defendants would be tried in downtown Manhattan or tried in a military commission.
And yet, once they went down that road of putting KSM and the others back in military commissions, didn't that make it almost impossible for the president to keep his promise to close Gitmo?
Absolutely. Although by that time, Congress had passed laws that would have allowed that barred bringing detainees from Gitmo into the United States. So it would have made it hard anyway. You know, the thing that I did uncover in my reporting, which is, I think, an interesting irony about this whole argument about military commissions versus civilian trials. The argument is basically that military commissions are tougher. It'll be easier to send these people away for life or have them executed in military commissions. Civilian courts have too many technicalities, too much concern about procedural rights and that sort of thing. What I uncovered in my reporting was that not long after the Holder Justice Department began looking at the evidence to make a determination whether to do it in New York, they uncovered the fact that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and a number of other of the 9/11 defendants who were at Guantanamo were had been surreptitiously recorded by the military. They would go into the prison yard and they would have conversations, completely voluntary. These were not interrogations. These were just conversations they were having with their future co-defendants. And in those conversations, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed admitted and boasted about his role in the 9/11 attacks. Well, that's significant because it's entirely uncoerced evidence. You can't say that he said these things because he was tortured. He was boasting about these things. The great irony that I discovered was that the military knew about these recordings. They had obviously done them, but they refused to use the evidence. They were worried that military judges would consider this to be an intrusion of the privacy of these suspects. And as a result, they wouldn't even listen to them because they didn't want their case to be tainted. The prosecutors at the Justice Department thought this was crazy. It was, you know, bordering on malpractice. You know, they use jailhouse conversations in trials all across the country every day. And so the irony there is the military commissions, which were supposed to be tougher, actually were less resilient than the civilian courts.
Dan Kleidman from Newsweek. We've been talking about some of the reporting in his new book, Kill or Capture, and we'll continue in a minute on the topic of the investigations that were launched last week into leaks that may have helped Dan write this book. Did White House officials tell him things that endanger national security to make the president look tough? Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we continue with Dan Kleidman from Newsweek. We've been talking about some of the reporting in his new book, Kill or Capture. Now to the investigations that were launched last week into leaks that may have helped Dan write this book. Dan, did White House officials tell you things that endanger national security to make the president look tough for his reelection campaign?
Well, look, I'm not going to talk about who my sources are in a kind of a particular way. I spoke to national security officials from across the government. I spoke to people in the relevant agencies. I did speak to people in the White House. My feeling about this is that, first of all, responsible reporters, and I think all the people who've been caught up in this potential investigation are responsible. When they're in possession of national security information, where there's some real question as to whether it could in some way endanger the lives of American service members, for example, we don't treat this cavalierly. We go to the relevant agencies. We raise the questions. It doesn't mean that if the CIA or some agency says you can't report that, we unthinkingly don't report it. But we debate it, and I think we make responsible judgments.
Well, do you think you were ever being spun specifically to make the president look tough, whether or not it endangered anyone's security?
Look, people who work for the president, political appointees in any administration are always trying to help the president and make him look good. But the issue here is, you know, the way this story has played out and some of the allegations that you're hearing from politicians on Capitol Hill, it's as if there's some concerted campaign to reach out to reporters and to try to, you know, bolster the president's national security credentials. It's just not the way it works. You know, I've been working on this book for 2 years. I had to fight and scratch and claw to get access to people, to persuade people to talk to me. It's not as if this is handed
right
to us on a silver platter.
Sure. You don't sit around like a stenographer waiting for David Axelrod to slip you juicy morsels. You've done this deep investigative book. But they know you're there. They know you're looking for stuff, and they can try to use you, right?
Absolutely. And, we take that into account. If reporters decided that they would never report anything in which the source had some potential agenda then there would not be a lot of important reporting in newspapers and magazines and on the air.
Well, here's an example from your book that's been cited in some news organizations. This particular one comes from The Atlantic. Jack Goldsmith from Harvard Law School, former Bush administration official, is talking here and says, Dan Kleidman's new book confirms this leaking for political purposes. In connection with the CIA killing of Baitullah Massoud in August 2009, Kleidman reports, in direct contradiction of the president, that is when the president says none of this would ever happen, it's offensive to think this would happen for political purposes. Now, quote from your book, though the program was not covert, White House Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel pushed the CIA to publicize, I'm sorry, though the program was covert, big mistake, though the program was covert, White House Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel pushed the CIA to publicize its covert successes. When Massoud was killed, agency public affairs officers anonymously trumpeted their triumph, leaking colorful tidbits. That's from your book.
And that is a true story. Let me just make one distinction here. The drone program is technically a covert program. There are very few people out there who don't know of its existence. And when a drone is fired in Pakistan or in some other place and, high-value targets such as Baitullah Massoud are killed, the whole world knows about it very quickly. So while it is true that in this instance, the White House, particularly Rahm Emanuel, was trying to get the word out and trying to make sure that people knew about these successes, I think it would be hard to argue that those kinds of leaks were actually harmful to national security. So I would just make that distinction, but stand by my reporting.
And the article in The Atlantic goes on to quote Scott Shane from The New York Times, another reported recipient of leaks, who says the administration's inconsistency has been particularly evident on the drone program. Officials routinely give reporters limited information on strikes, usually on the condition of anonymity. So why leak it to you or to the New York Times? Why not just release the information publicly if it's not going to be damaging to national security and it's a success that they could legitimately trumpet, or just a fact of war for the public to digest and debate?
Well, I think the administration and at senior levels, and I imagine the president as well, are genuinely torn about this. I think that they would like to be more transparent about the drone program, and I think there's evidence to suggest that over the last few months, actually going back to 2010, there have been a series of speeches by senior administration officials. The most recent was John Brennan just a few weeks ago, talking about the drone program. And, they don't go as far as I would like to see them go. But I think you're seeing slightly more transparency on this issue because they believe that, first of all, they're under pressure to be more transparent. But they also want people to understand how the program works, because they fundamentally get the point that this program, which is controversial, not so much with most of the American people, but it is controversial with some and internationally, that if they're going to maintain public and international support for this program, which they believe in, they're going to have to talk about it and explain it more.
Daniel Kleidman from Newsweek. His new book is Kill or Capture: The War on Terror and the Soul of the Obama Presidency. Also being mentioned, as we've been discussing, in this investigation of White House leaks. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, and Hussein in Queens. You're on the air. Hello, Hussein. Hussein, you there?
Yes, sir. How are you?
Good. Thanks for calling again. How you doing?
Mr. Brian, I have one question for you, sir.
Go ahead.
That how many Muslims you have on your program for the last 2 years who does not endorse the policy of the United States, and I never transgress whatever I tell you.
Hussein, the answer to that question is plenty. And do you have a question for Dan Kleidman?
Yes, sir. I have one question for you, sir, that in First World War, about 13 million people, they were killed. In Second World War, 70 million human beings were killed. In Post-World War, 120 million human beings were killed. and now we are in 21st century. So what is all this? All these things depend on one focal point, that when we stop doing action militarily all over the world, it is military who is killing everybody on this earth.
Hussein, thank you. And, you know, to I think what is the underlying outrage that he's experiencing and how I think it relates to your book, I'm struck by the difference in the national debate over the leaks and the tone of your book. The Republicans are asking, did the White House leak to you to make the president look tough in the war on terror? Hussein is asking, and I think your central question seems to be more about, did the president lose his moral compass by becoming the warrior he did? Would you put it that way?
Yeah, I think that's right. I also think that, look, this discussion has revolved largely around drone strikes. The book is about all of President Obama's policies in the war on terror and how he has tried to balance these issues of liberty and security and politics and principle. And he struggled for much of his presidency. And much of my book is critical of the president for not showing enough will on some of these issues. So the idea that this was all about emboldening this president and turning him into a tough warrior is belied by what I write about in the book, I think.
You write about these dramatic scenes where the president is called away from his family, and he hates being called away from his wife and daughters, specifically to make a decision about whether to authorize a kill. And I wonder if you think that he has been authorizing kills of individual suspected terrorists in Pakistan or Yemen or anywhere that surprised you in terms of the values that you think he came in with and how he has changed.
Yeah, you know, one thing that's been lost in this debate is, I think, the reason that Obama decided he wanted to be so centrally involved in these killing decisions. I think it's twofold. I think one, he did understand that this was an extraordinary thing to make for the government to make individual killing decisions, and he wanted to act as a kind of a constraining force in some ways on the military. He was also worried about the way military action can kind of spin out of control, and was worried about, frankly, mission creep and opening up new fronts. But to your question, he was a rather supple decision maker. Sometimes he would say, no, let's not go after these particular people because they are not demonstrable threats to the United States security. Sometimes he could be persuaded. One time, actually, in mid-operation, where he had said no about a particular target in Yemen, and all of a sudden, David Petraeus, the general who was at that point in charge of that area, was on the phone and trying to persuade the president that they should be able to go after that target who they had a clean shot at. And the president said, well, is it a legal strike? Would there be much collateral damage? Is it the right policy? He got the right answers to all those questions. And in mid-execution, he agreed. They killed the guy. But some time later, in quiet conversations with his closest counterterrorism aides, he wondered whether it was the right decision. Did we really know that this person was a threat? So he would go back and forth. He was not the unflinching, terrorist hunter that sometimes he's depicted to be. And in some ways, that's reassuring.
Was Bush one, or did he even get involved personally in decisions like that?
It's interesting. Everybody remembers Bush's cards that had the names of all the terrorists on them, and he would sort of notches on his belt when the military or the CIA would kill or capture one. He did not get involved in the same way that Obama did on these personal decisions. He was, remember, the CEO president. He would delegate. That's quite a difference from President Obama.
That is something to delegate. Who gets killed on a case-by-case basis? Robert in Bridgeport, you're on WNYC with Dan Clydman. Hello.
Hi. I was interested in you mentioning the Bush administration. I'm a reporter. I did an article in the Village Voice in October 07 concerning a supposed delay in getting Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act authority to wiretap insurgents who had abducted three U.S. soldiers in May of that year in Iraq. It was leaked to the press, and it was published by the Times and the Associated Press, that because foreign-to-foreign telephone calls passed through United States switches, and because of a court ruling, which would have had to have been by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, warrants were now necessary to intercept those calls. After I'd done that article for The Voice, I found out from a senior official at the Federal Communications Commission that those calls do not come to the United States. They do not come to the United States. They are connected locally.
And what's your question
to
Dan?
Hello?
Yeah, what's your question to Dan?
Well, it's just that I was just making the comment that I feel that the Bush administration manipulated what was in fact national security information in order to get a political victory over the Democrats that year when they got the Protect America Act passed.
So it was going on the very things that the Republicans are accusing the Obama folks of now, they were doing at that time.
Exactly, except that the information was not even true.
Robert, thank you for your call.
And on that point, I would say there were plenty of books during the Bush administration that talked a lot about, people might remember Bob Woodward's series of books, Bush at War, in which he had full access to people in the White House, to the president himself. And when you read that book, people were astonished by how much information was in there that could be classified as national security information.
Would you ever turn away a leak that advanced what you thought was the public knowledge if you thought it was being leaked to you illegally?
It depends on what the circumstances of what kind of illegality was being committed. If it's stolen information, it's hard to say, make a blanket statement about that. But generally speaking, I'm a reporter. My job is to publish, I will take into account people's motives. But if it's accurate information and it's compelling and it's in the public interest, I'm going to publish.
You think Congress or the Justice Department or anybody else is going to make you testify about this?
I certainly hope not. I worry about these kinds of allegations coming up in a kind of heated political environment, and that there's often a kind of a rush to judgment. One thing that I think there's not been a lot of discussion of, even though my book and the New York Times piece is being bandied about in these stories, is, well, what specifically are we talking about? What are the leaks, and how do they damage national security? And on the other side, let's hear people talk about the fact that there is it is in the public interest to understand why and how officials make these kinds of critical decisions. After all, we have for the first time in our history, in a systematic way, officials and the President of the United States making individual killing decisions on behalf of the American people. We need to understand how those decisions are made, what the legal basis is, what kind of moral dilemmas they confront, when they decide to kill and when they decide to spare people's lives. That's really critically important.
Dan Clydman from Newsweek, his new book, Kill or Capture: The War on Terror and the Soul of the Obama Presidency. Listeners, you can keep this conversation going on our comments page at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Dan, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian.
Coming up next, the writer Siri Hustvedt explores reading, writing, and memory as part of what it means to be human. Stay with us.